Working Cows Podcast, Episode 95.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. Very excited to welcome Steve Kenyon back for another episode. I finished my last episode with Steve, and I saw very shortly thereafter a post from him about the calendar of the year-round grazer. And I said, you know, if he's got a book, we got to talk about it on the Working Cows Podcast. So we will have links to Steve's book and where you can get that from the Stockman Grass Farmer up at workingcows.net/95. So make sure you check that out at workingcows.net/95. And we will link to that there. So, Steve, I'm really excited to have you back on. Welcome back to the Working Cows Podcast.
You bet. Thanks.
We'll start in January kind of because seems like the year works out well for you so that you can do the most important things in the first part of the year during a slow time, and then you can move on to the production practices, but you've got to get your human resources, your economics and finance right before you can hope to be successful with the rest. Am I kind of summarizing that right?
Yes, you bet. The book worked out quite well. It kind of follows along my year-round grazing system school. To me, the most important part of any business is the human resources. And, you know, what better time to do that is at the beginning. Get that all in order. I mean, most businesses fail, most employees quit over human resources, not anything else. What is it? The number one turnover, employee turnover rate is due to human resources, not job ability. So, just kind of the book follows along the school. The economics and finances are also very important. It's something your business has to have under control for it to be successful. Long before any of the production practices are a top priority, right? Everybody loves production practices, but the business side is much more important.
Sure. And when you are talking about human resources, and that's in the book, the calendar of the year-round grazer, copy of which will be available to purchase by following the link at workingcows.net/95. If you go to workingcows.net/95, you'll find the show notes page for today. A copy of Steve's book will be linked there. And when people follow the calendar of the year-round grazer, they start off in January with human resources, and you talk about all the different relationships that you're managing in your business. So we've talked before about your business model being that of a custom grazer. What are some of the business relationships that you're managing, the human resources relationships that you're managing in your business?
Okay, other than right within the business, I mean, there's I've got an employee, I've got my wife and my kids. Those are all relationships right within the business. But a lot of businesses also have relationships just outside of the business that the business is dependent on. For example, all of my landowners. That's a big one for me, right? I go for a lot of tea and cookies, right? Like they are important to me. Their desires, their wants, their needs, make sure we're taking care of their land the way they want it. And just the personal side to it. Sit down, have coffee with them and be friends with them, basically. Some of them end up being sort of family. We've got to make sure we foster those relationships or we start losing land. I know I've had a lot of people offer more money for some of the land they have, but because I've fostered this good relationship with the landowners. They like what I do. They like my family. They like the business structure I'm in, how I take care of the environment. Right. I've talked to them about that. I've taught them about the importance of soil biology, and they appreciate what I'm doing. And even if somebody offers them more money, they stick with me. That's what's important in those relationships. And there's customers. I also have many different cattle customers that come in, feed suppliers that I have to deal with and work out deals with. So there's lots of business relationships just outside the business that is very important so that my business can survive.
Right. And you talk about the fact that most of your land relationships or the relationships with the landowners that you are grazing on are done on a handshake. And then on the other side of that, your cattle customers, there's a contract involved on that end of it. Can you talk about that relationship with the landowner? How long of a agreement do you want to have in place before you're willing to commit to bring in cattle to a place, or how does that look for you?
So most of my landowners, we start out with a contract. At least we go through one, right? We need to be able to talk about all the different points of what could happen, right? Over the years, I've added things because of, you know, instances that have occurred that I need to cover. But we go through it, we read it. Some of the times they want to sign one, some of the times they don't, right? A lot of my landowners are, you know, old school, you know, retired. We talk about it and a handshake's good enough for them. And some of those, landowners, I've had land for, you know, 19, 20 years. And some of the other types of landowners I have are new to the country, right? They're city folk that, have some money and they want to invest in something. They moved to the country, to get out of there, but they don't have much ties to the land. They need to, you know, I need to teach them a little bit about how this all works and how renting land works. So definitely going through a contract with them. Some of them sign them. Some of them don't need it. Normally what happens is we sign the first contract. Maybe I try to go for at least five-year deal, maybe 10 if I can get it. But some of them only want two or three. And if they do, then we sign that and we carry forward. And then it's a matter of building up trust. And in this case, on the landowner side, the trust is I'm going to pay them, right? It's kind of a one-sided trust. I need to prove it. And once we get that trust established, they like what I'm doing. They see the improvement to the land. When it comes time to renew the contract, they just say, oh, yeah, carry on, whatever you do. And then from that point on, it's kind of a usually ends up being just a handshake deal after that, assuming that the original contract is still carries forward. But yeah, a lot of my landowners now, they're just every year they're like, yeah, you bet, it's yours. It's all your land. Don't worry about it. So that contract technically is expired, but it's still valid in their mind too. So a lot of my landowners end up just doing that.
What are you generally, you're going in first year and you're putting in infrastructure in most cases? Is that would that be typical?
Yeah, in our area, most land that I'm getting is already perimeter fenced. There might be a water source. There might be a corral system. Every land is different, obviously. And I go in with the calculating out a gross margin analysis, estimating it already, figuring out what my costs are going to be. You know, is it a good fence? Is there water there? And put some numbers to it. And that can help me determine what my rent could be. I use a bit of a formula of a rent ratio to estimate what I can afford to pay for rent on something compared to what it could produce.
Sure. So that takes us out of the human resources portion of your book, which is chapter one, January, into the economics. And that is February's chapter about economics and doing the gross margin analysis. How are you, what are you using? Or can you talk a little bit more, sorry, about those rent ratios and the gross margin analysis and some of those things?
Yeah, the gross margin analysis, kind of a full farm analysis that we break down. We want to look at each profit center individually, break them down, get a margin. That margin goes to cover your business overheads and looks at the overall farm profitability. On an individual basis, the gross margin ratio, I'm just looking at, you know, one field at a time. A little smaller scale compared to the full farm analysis. But they all tie in. It's all the same process of, you know, just math. It's got a simple big number minus little number, and hopefully you get a positive margin out of that. But in all, it's a very important part of the business, almost as important as the human resources. But determining if your business is economical versus is it financial, there's two different sets of numbers. There's a difference between economics and finances. Economics is profitability, right? Is your business going to make a profit? And finances ends up being, can I afford to do it? Is there a way that I can come up with the money in advance to be able to get this done so that I can make the money? So I look at those as two different sets of books. The economics I do with a gross margin analysis, and the finances we look at through a cash flow on a month-to-month basis.
And you give credit in the book to Ranching for Profit and to the holistic management schools of thought. Have you tweaked their method at all in your economic analysis and made it your own in some way?
Oh, yes, definitely. Basically, I take the information that I gather from all these different schools. Ranching for Profit and Holistic Management were two of the big ones that I've taken information from. And basically, I just tweaked it to make it work for my farm. That's how it originally came out and made those numbers work. I made up some charts that I liked that worked for my environment. And then after that, that's when I started making my school and doing seminars and courses. So it's kind of a blend of a whole bunch of different schools. I know the TPAP course was in there too. That's the out of Texas, the executive program for agriculture producers. That was one that I got some information from. Dick Divin's low-cost cow-calf. Gerald Fry's school, lots of different schools and seminars and schools of thought that I've adapted things from.
And we'll get into all that more in just a little bit. But you are custom grazing, and you talk about in the book selling some cows to go to the Ranching for Profit school. How long, or is it just going to be a market decision as to when you may or may not purchase cattle that you would own again? Is that something that you would like to get to, or is the market not there yet, but it might be at some point? How are you thinking about those things?
Oh, that's a tough question because it's different in every environment. It changes year to year. Overall, my perspective of the cattle industry is it's a tough business. There's a lot of people in it that don't necessarily understand their economics. So what we're doing is there's a whole bunch of people that produce a product that is under cost. And if you flood a market with a product that's produced under cost, then, you know, nobody makes any money. So we've got, I think I heard a phrase from Australia one time that if everybody who was losing money stopped raising cattle, then the rest of the people would actually make a decent living at it. There's too many hobby farmers, and as in hobby farmers, I'm not talking little farmers either. There's a lot of very large hobby farmers that they're not making a profit in the cattle business. And you put all those calves on the market, well then, you know, the price goes down. So it is a tough business as it is. There's a lot of overhead costs. There's a lot of opportunity costs put into that. I mean, just owning that herd alone is a huge opportunity cost, where there's other profit centers that don't have that. So I'm not saying you can't make profit in owning cattle, but it is a tough venture. So as of right now, I'm quite content not owning cattle. Not saying I won't in the future, but there's other profit centers that have better margins.
Absolutely. Yep. And I kind of guessed that was your answer, but I wanted to hear for sure. And we've talked a lot of times on the podcast about the fact that you can be cash flow positive, but economically losing money. And since we haven't quite jumped off of this economic analysis portion of your book, could you talk a little bit about how that might come to pass where you're cash flow positive, but economically not profitable?
There's a numerous different scenarios where that could work, and it could be the other way around too. You could be making a profit, but you can't cash flow it, or you could cash flow something but not make a profit. I've had bankers try and push me in one direction, basically because I could finance it, but it was completely and totally economically unsound. So every scenario is different, and you've got to be able to do both. Now, I've also heard people say, well, what's more important, the profitability or the cash flow? In some cases, I've heard people talk about, well, you've got to have the cash flow so that eventually you can make a profit. Like a lot of businesses start up right away, they're not making a profit, but they need to have the cash flow to continue to where they can get to the point where, let's say, they have enough customers or they have enough market that then they can be profitable. But they got to get through those first couple of years of being financially stable to be able to get to that point, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So two different sides to it, definitely.
Sure. Do you think that depreciation is typically the thing that people aren't figuring in that would lead them to be cash flow positive, but economically not profitable?
It's one of the factors, definitely. Depreciation needs to be accounted for as your equipment or even your animals or your assets basically lose value over time. We've got to be able to replace that. But, you know, cattle can depreciate too over time. Your 3-year-old cow you buy is worth more than that 10-year-old cow, usually. So we've got to account for depreciation in all of our business. The other things they don't account for is, of course, opportunity cost and inflation. They all have to be accounted for in your business.
Can you talk a little bit about opportunity cost that takes up a portion of your book?
Yeah, opportunity cost, sometimes it's kind of hard for people to wrap their head around. It's a measurement of your management, basically. It is a interest charged on the asset that you own. So if you were to buy all your assets right from scratch, you know, get a loan and buy them, then you have an interest payment that you have to make on those assets. But if you already own them, you don't have that payment, right? Let's say you've worked for years or years, or even you've inherited or you already own that asset. You don't have that payment. But if to make your business repeatable, right, let's say like a franchise would be a McDonald's or an A&W, where you can take that business model and replicate it and have it successful. So if you wanted to have your farm repeatable, you've got to be able to make sure that somebody can buy the entire thing, the land, the animals, the equipment, and have a loan on that and still be able to turn a profit. Even if your farm is partially paid for or mostly paid for, the equipment's paid for, we need to put an opportunity cost on the value of those assets to make sure that that business model can be repeatable. That's where the opportunity cost comes in.
Very good. And we've talked a lot so far about economic analysis, and we'll transition now to some production practices, for some red meat, I guess. But is this stuff the same stuff that is covered in your schools that you've been doing with Joel Salatin? And is that something that you're going to continue to do, or was that a one-year deal?
Yeah, no, that's definitely what we talk about. Part of it, of course, Joel's got half the school in there as well, and all his information, which is phenomenal stuff. I love listening to it every time. But yes, definitely the economics and finances is in there, and the human resources. And yes, we're planning on doing one of these every year. So look forward to a new place every year. We're trying to get all across North America with the school, so everybody has a chance to get to that.
Cool. Sounds good. Just a quick break. We are releasing this after the deadline for the High Plains Ranch practicum. There is still room. If you want to get in, you can contact as soon as possible Aaron Berger or Dallas Mount and get in on this year's class, the last class they're doing. Great guest teachers, great curriculum, great time of being challenged by other people who are making decisions day in and day out that affect their ranch business. So I'd encourage you to consider being a part of the final class of the High Plains Ranch Practicum. Check it out at hpranchpracticum.com. So now we will move on to some production practices. If you feel like I haven't haven't missed too much so far. I don't want to give away the whole book. I want people to go and buy it, and they can do that by visiting workingcows.net/95. So we've talked about human resources, economics, cash flow, or economics and finance, and then we get into April, which is grazing. And
yes.
I think in April is when you talk about the most common question you get is, what should I plant to improve my pastures? And if you feel like we're not giving away too much, I appreciated your answer to that question.
Yeah, basically, yeah, I get asked that a lot. What do we plant? Everybody's got the farming mentality of what species, what seed do we plant? Everybody's looking for a magic bullet. You know, this new type of fertilizer or a new chemical that's going to totally, you know, turn around your farm and make it profitable, when really it's just the basics. To me, we need to plant fence posts to make sure that we can control the grazing. So that's kind of the introduction to the four grazing concepts, which is graze period, rest period, stock density, and animal impact. By planting some fence posts, we have the ability to control those four concepts. And that's how we stop overgrazing, and that's how we improve production on our pasture land. Pretty quick version of it, but yeah, those are the four concepts that we need to get our heads wrapped around before we just buying a magic bullet here or there. A new product isn't gonna solve the long term problem of overgrazing. So we need to address that first.
Sure, and I think. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but graze period and rest period are pretty self-explanatory. Animal impact would be the laying down of a cover, and the stock density is about spreading manure, right?
Close, you bet. Graze period is the amount of time on a pasture. The rest period is the amount of time in between grazings, obviously. Stock density, there's actually two benefits to stock density. One is knocking down that forage, and what I refer to as plant utilization, right? Every plant gets either knocked down, eaten, or, you know, broken in some way. That way they have all the plants have an even playing field coming back, right? No plant gets an advantage. That undesirable plant doesn't get to go to seed and reproduce and has all the advantage. We want to get that stock density high enough that all of them get knocked to the ground in one way or another. And the other benefit to that higher stock density is manure distribution, right? We spread the manure out better. With low stock density, we end up having manure in concentrated areas, or, you know, by the trees or by the watering area. The higher the stock density, the better that manure gets spread out. And then animal impact is actually the physical stimulation on the soil by the animals. Now, this can be, you know, by their hooves, you know, breaking capped soil, recycling the forage, causing seed-to-soil contact, just with the physical stimulation of the hooves. And there's also the biological stimulation, right? They like to drop saliva on the ground, and, you know, their snotty nose gets dripped on the ground, their urine and their manure gets on the ground. All this is benefits to the biology, right? We're adding microbes to the soil. We're adding food for the microbes to the soil. It's one part of that animal impact, how the animal affects the soil.
Yeah, and I really appreciated Chapter 5. Just to buzz across some of the headings here before we move on to Chapter 6, water holding capacity, sunlight harvesting, nutrients, and biological life. Just some good stuff in there, obviously worth the read, worth the time invested to go through it. As I was reading through this book, I thought this is like a two-hour webinar introduction to Ranching for Profit refresher course that would be really helpful for people to read multiple times, more maybe once a year at least or something, as they're thinking about starting their year off right. So we look at Chapter 6 is June, how much gain is left. Some of the things out of that chapter, probably more highlights in this chapter for me than any other, but I have some pastures that if I take half, there is not near enough residue left over to cover the ground. I might need to leave it all, and sometimes I do. On good years, I will skip one of the poorest producing paddocks in my pasture and allow all of the growth to stay as residue. I have some pastures that have so much growth that if I leave a quarter of the forage, we have plenty of residue cover. So just some good stuff there that I really appreciated. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, this was written a few years ago, I've got a little bit of an addition to the book that's probably not written in there near as much as I talk about now. One of the biggest nutrients that I manage on my ranch, actually the only nutrient I manage on my ranch, is water. Agriculture spends so much time worrying about nitrogen and maybe phosphorus and potassium and sulfur. But water is the most important nutrient, by far. For every 50 pounds of nitrogen needed, you need 10,000 pounds of water. So definitely water is the biggest nutrient. So, just in that phrase you just talked about leaving residue, that's what we're holding. The more residue you leave, the more water you get. Right. So on those good years when we get lots of rain, we've got lots of forage growth, then leave more, put more down. So in that phrase too, when I would skip an entire paddock, well, it's my poorest producing one. What I'm doing is leaving an entire, maybe not a year, or at least one grazing, leaving the entire grazing out on the land for residue. The more residue I have out there, the more thatch that gets built up the next year, and then the more water holding capacity I have. So that's a big part of that is building water holding capacity in your soil. Now, in a really wet environment, that might not be a big deal to you, but in a drier environment like ours, then that is a very important aspect of my grazing. If I could go back 20 years and tell myself one thing to improve my grazing faster, would be to leave more residue. I was 20 years ago, I was doing all sorts of rotations and, you know, moving fences around, and I had the grazing concept down, but the one thing that I was missing is leaving more residue so that I could hold water.
And I can't talk to Steve Kenyon without mentioning his great Facebook page, and I really encourage you to make sure that you've liked it and are visiting it regularly. I have it on follow, and then you can go to the see first setting so that every time you open the app, if Steve's posted something new, it pops up there and you see it every time. And so because Facebook is intentionally broken so that pages have to pay for you to see their stuff, that's one way that you as a consumer of content can get around that. So I would recommend you do that. And one of the things that I've been seeing lately related to kind of this portion of the book and planting posts is that you plant, as far as I've seen on your stuff, is exclusively wood posts, and you use just a regular staple and I'm guessing a 14 gauge high tensile wire. Is that on your exterior fences, I'm assuming?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways of fencing. I use a lot of different things. I don't use a lot of insulators anymore. I'm tired of fixing plastic insulators. They haven't invented one that I like yet. And I've come down to just putting a staple on. We have a lot of wildlife pressure out here, moose and deer and things that walk through the fences. So plastic insulators just don't work. They just frustrate me. I've got 72 miles of fence to check every year, and I'm tired of replacing plastic insulators. So a good 2-inch barbed staple holding on the wire. I'll use high tensile wire. I'll use barbed wire. I'll use whatever wire is, you know, cheap and easily accessible. If I find some cheap at an auction sale, well, that's the wire I'm going to use. Just power less fence. A fencer will say that it's good for, you know, power and 60 miles of fence. Well, I can put staples in my wood posts, and all I need to do is power 2 miles of fence with it. And I still have really good voltage in it. Even when it rains, I still get pretty good voltage. I'll drop 3 or 4 kilovolts because of the rain. But if you started out with 9, you're still doing pretty good.
One of the things, I tend to go in spurts just where my head's been at, and one of the things I've been talking a lot about lately on the Working Cows podcast is waging war on costs, and another thing that I've mentioned a couple of times in recent weeks is people who use mini SUVs instead of side-by-sides as their large ATVs, and you talk about that, about the equipment that you have, and you're running a very low equipment operation. We've talked about that before as well, but and you mentioned that you used, or at the time this book was written, you were using a geotracker as your large ATV. Can you talk about the cost savings that is involved in using something like that over a side-by-side?
Yeah, you bet. I still got one. I think this is my fourth one. They're older. But I can buy one for like $1,500.
Right.
They're pretty cheap. My frustration with owning an ATV is that they break down more often and the repairs are expensive. So I've stopped working here with an ATV or a quad. Now I use the GeoTracker. Repairs are less frequent and usually cheaper to fix. And actually they were built very simple. It's quite easy to do repairs. I usually have an old one here for a part. And I remember here, what is it, last year or the year before, I ran a branch through the radiator of the front end, right? Broke the grill and right through the radiator and damaged the radiator. So I went to the old tracker and undid two bolts and two hose clamps, pulled out the radiator and switched them across, right? They're just very simple. I'm not a mechanical person, but I switched the radiator in like 20 minutes in this thing. So they're built very, very easy and very maintenance free. And when you do a repair on them, they're usually not that complicated. So to me, it was a big money saver. I think a couple of years ago, the clutch went in one of them, and it was going to be a $1,200 repair bill. So I went out and I bought another one for $1,500. Right? So someday I might upgrade to a little newer version, but I really like these things right now. And they're like I said, kind of a dime a dozen. You can buy another one pretty cheap. So.
Right. They don't tend to be too proud of them when they're selling them. they're ready to get rid of them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I'm just going to beat them up on a pasture anyway. So if they only last 2 years, that's fine.
Yeah, you can buy 10 of those for what you can buy one side by side for. So.
Yeah, $1,500 versus $26,000, right? Yeah, no, thanks. I'm good. And it comes with a windshield and a heater and a radio. So I'm pretty happy with my trackers.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your resource base or, you know, what kind of a year that you're dealing with there as far as snow cover and moisture and those things?
Our environment. Yeah. So we live near Edmonton, Alberta. So we're fairly high up on the hemisphere, I guess you would call it. We get quite a bit of snow in the winter. We'll have anywhere from a foot to 3 feet of snow usually in the wintertime. We can get some pretty cold temperatures. Minus 47 is pretty chilly. Fahrenheit or Celsius,
right, they're pretty close at that point.
Cold. Yeah, they're pretty even there. That's about the coldest we get. But in the summertime, we have some beautiful days. You know, we'll get up to plus 40, which in Fahrenheit would be 105, 110, somewhere in there, I'm thinking.
Probably.
So we can get some warm weather as well. Quite a drastic change in temperature, right? Like from very hot days to very, very cold days in a year. And so our growing season's fairly short. We'll start getting some green growth end of April, and our killing frost hits usually first or second week in September. So our growing season's pretty short. We've got four and a half months to grow 12 months worth of forage. The advantage is our days are longer in the summer, so we get quite a bit of sunlight, and we can get quite a bit of growth during those 4 months. And my environment here, I'm not going to say it's really dry, but in a growing season, I think on average we're 14 to 15 inches of rain. We've actually had some drier years in the past, so I think our average is coming down. I think according to our government right in our area here, they've got a weather station right close to us. In the last 11 years, we've had 7 years of drought, according to what the average is. So,
right.
Starting to tell me something.
Yeah.
We're having more flooding and more droughts and more extreme weather occurrences. So that's got to sink in somewhere. Something's happening.
Sure. And you talk about your harsh winter environment and how are you making sure that you do have a few cows that stick around year round? How are you making sure that they've got all the nutrients they need to make it through that harsh winter environment without having to take all of the feed to them?
Yeah, well, we're getting into the later part of the book now. Swath grazing and bale grazing, residue grazing. So different ways of getting through the winter. Residue grazing would be taking the residues off the back of a combine. right, out in the field. So I work with other grain farmers. I don't actually grow any grain fields, but I work with other producers. And we move cattle out and graze residues, pea straw or barley residue or something like that, get them through part of it. Some of that we have to supplement because it's not necessarily always high in nutrients, so we have to supplement out there as well. But we do some feed tests and make sure we get them adequate nutrition. A big thing up here, too, is to get them some wind protection. When it gets really cold, that wind can really, really affect that temperature or the wind chill factor, too. So we've got a lot of trees. So I make sure that there's always an area that they can hide right beside or within the trees when it gets really cold. Snow actually acts as an insulator. If you've got nice, fresh, fluffy snow and it's really cold, they lay in it, then they it actually helps keep them warm, if you can imagine that.
Sure.
If they're constantly into the snow and they pack it down and it's just ice, well, then they're laying on ice, and then that doesn't help at all. But fresh snow actually works as an insulator, so when it gets cold, I can turn them into a fresh area with trees and fresh snow, and that really helps them to stay warm. They huddle up in the trees, and they stop the wind from blowing the heat away, and they can keep a lot of their own body heat within that area, as long as that wind doesn't blow it away.
Sure.
I guess the other trick to really cold weather would be to feed them in the late afternoon or early evening. Then peak rumination would occur in the middle of the night. That's when their body, the ruminant, is doing most of the digesting, and that's when it's producing most of the heat. So if we can time that so that it's in the coldest part of the night, then that helps keep the whole herd warm, too, just by when you feed.
Right. And in your case, would you be saying feeding is letting them on to fresh, a fresh bale graze or fresh residue graze?
Yeah, or like out on a residue would be if I'm supplementing with, let's say I'm going to unroll one or two bales. So maybe I would move the fence in the afternoon and unroll a couple of bales, you know, that evening or late afternoon or early evening. It would be the timing on when they fill their gut, right? If you did it in the morning, then their peak rumination would be, you know, after lunch sometime, when it's usually not as cold. Usually the coldest part of the day is at night. So just trying to time it so that peak rumination, where their bodies are making the most heat, is at the coldest part of the night.
A couple of things. One thing I feel like I left on the table is how much gain is left. And rather than asking, did we take half, leave half, looking at a pasture and asking yourself how much gain is left. And so that's just going to be a tease for everybody so that they are motivated to go and check out the book. But then I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about the last chapter of your book and the importance of being a lifelong learner.
Education. To me, most of my education has come from private industry schools, right? We already mentioned Rancher and Profit and Holistic Management, but also books I've read, seminars I've taken. I can't miss Jim Gerrish and all the work he's done. He's been a mentor of mine as well. There's lots of different seminars and conferences and speakers that I've listened to over the years that I've all, you know, adapted the information to my farm. You can't do exactly what they do, right? Like my suggestion is you can't farm exactly like I farm. Your environment's different. Your farm is different. You're different. But you can take the idea and you can adapt it to your farm. The idea is the important part that I'm trying to give to people. Okay, well, it might not work exactly the same on your farm, but that idea might trigger something to make your farm a little bit more profitable.
Absolutely. Very good. Steve, anything I missed today? Anything else you want to share?
I've had people ask me to describe my book before, and basically I describe it as being blunt. Right? It's short. I'd say it's sweet, but it's not. Short and sweet. I made it so that it wasn't a hard read. I want to have it quick, to the point, and just to make it so that anybody can read it. I've read a lot of books over the years that are, you know, very good books, but, I just get three quarters of the way through them and I don't finish them just because they're so long. There's so much fluff put into them. So I wanted to make sure that anybody, even if you're not a big reader, that it's easy to read this one and get the valuable information out of it. So that's how I describe it. It's very blunt. It's straight and to the point and a quick read.
Yep, that is a very accurate description of the book. Very good. I think you're kind of through your busy travel and speaking season. Any major things that are coming up that you want to share?
Yeah, no, we focus in the summertime mostly on the ranch here. We've got about 1,200 head of cattle coming in as we speak. Actually, I had two more trucks coming in today. As soon as this phone call's done, I'm off to receive some more cattle. And that's mostly what we do. We do the odd pasture walk in the summertime. We do one for us and the odd place somewhere else. But pretty busy in the summer and don't do much speaking engagement. So that'll start up again, you know, November, December, and carry on through the winter.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for taking time out of a busy time of your year.
You bet. Glad to pass the information along.
I really appreciate Steve joining me again. And speaking of the High Plains Ranch Practicum, we've got Aaron Berger coming up next week. We're going to talk to him about the decisions and the things you would have to consider when considering moving your calving season date. And so really look forward to that discussion with Aaron. We'll see you next week with another episode of the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.